This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. Carl Sagan once called the Earth a mote of dust suspended in a sunbeam. It's our only home, but there are reasons to explore beyond it. For one, we might have to. Climate change or a fatefully placed asteroid could make this place really inhospitable really fast. But other than that, humans have thought about exploring the solar system for generations, from our fears of little green men to the thrilling prospects of colonizing space. Technology is getting us closer to that dream and to others. But what will it take to make these dreams come true? And how many predictions for the future will remain science fiction and never become fact? Joining us from NPR in New York is physics professor Michio Kaku of the City University of New York. Among other things, his work has included exploring the structure of the universe and creating string theory. His latest book is called The Future of Humanity: Terraforming Mars, Interstellar Travel, Immortality, and Our Destiny Beyond Earth. Professor Kaku, welcome to 1A.
Glad to be on the show.
How did this book come about?
Well, you know, I grew up in the space age with the Sputnik moment, and then we had 50 years when we didn't go beyond the Earth orbit anymore. NASA became basically the agency to nowhere. Now there's new energy, there's new enthusiasm going back into outer space. Costs have dropped enormously. NASA is teaming up with Silicon Valley billionaires to create a fleet of rockets that'll take us back to the moon starting next year, and then perhaps on to Mars. You know, just a few weeks ago, millions of people tuned into the internet to watch the launching of the Falcon Heavy rocket. That's different. That was a moon rocket, not an ordinary space shuttle. That was a moon rocket, fully capable of sending astronauts to the moon. And it was funded by, get this, it was funded by one man, private enterprise to the rescue there. And so it shows that we have a game changer, a new era. I called it a new golden age of space exploration. Costs have dropped dramatically. In fact, did you know that if you saw the movie with Matt Damon, The Martian, that movie cost over $100 million. That's more than the actual cost of a Mars mission that the Indians sent to Mars that cost $70 million. So Hollywood movies can essentially bankroll missions to Mars. That's how cheap space travel has become.
I do want to talk about the prospects for that, the very real prospects for it, and some of the other predictions that you have made. But I think we should probably begin by dealing with a very basal question that kind of frames the discussion. We asked some of you about your hopes for the next two decades, and here's one message that came to our inbox.
This is Will in Roseville, Minnesota. I understand the work that the futurists are doing looking 20 years out, but I'm far more concerned what's happening in 20-minute intervals, what with Donald Trump and his finger on the nuclear trigger and his counterpart in North Korea. Let's spend more time talking about how to prevent humanity-threatening nuclear war than worrying about 20 years. It's rather naive to assume there'll be a human race at that time.
Well, thanks very much for sharing your thoughts with us. I wonder, Professor Kaku, what you would say to folks like Will. It's nice to think about the future, but we got people catching hell right here on Earth right now. Shouldn't we be more concerned about today?
Well, we have two concerns. One is self-inflicted crises that we bring upon ourselves as human beings. We have global warming. We see the melting of the ice caps, the breaking up of the South Pole. We see glaciers receding around the world. Second, we see nuclear proliferation, as was correctly pointed out. Third, the threat of biogerms. Not only that, but Mother Nature has savagery unleashed when we see that all the time in the evening news. We have the possibility of, well, asteroid impacts. Look at what happened to Russia just twice in the last 100 years. Take a look at super volcanoes erupting in Indonesia. Take a look at the possibility of planetary crises. So what we're saying here, and what Carl Sagan said, given all these things, we need an insurance policy, not necessarily for today, tomorrow, but in the long term, an insurance policy, a plan B, to create a two-planet species. These are the words of Carl Sagan, a two-planet species that he told me. He said the Earth lives in the middle of a shooting gallery, and so we have to deal with all these crises. We just can't put our heads in the sand and say, let's deal with nuclear proliferation and forget about global warming, forget about biogerms. No, we have to attack all these problems, but we have to put them in sequence. We can't equate all these calamities simultaneously. And in the long term now, just remember that the dinosaurs did not have a space program. And they're not here today to talk about it. We do have a space program, and we can contemplate in the long term what it would take to defend the Earth. Because, let's face it, Mother Nature can hit us with all sorts of asteroids and supervolcanoes and ice ages, and we have to be mentally prepared.
Part of what's baked into Will's question, though, is how much energy we should be spending thinking about a Michael Bay movie becoming reality, and how much energy we should be spending trying to save the Earth we've got. I don't hear Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos saying a word about fighting climate change or environmental racism or protecting the oceans. I hear a lot about them talking about going to Mars on a trip that I will never be able to afford. How should we be balancing our energy on these different issues?
Well, first of all, it depends on what you mean by the word we. Taxpayers are not paying for the Falcon Heavy rocket. Elon Musk is giving us a moon rocket for free. For free. We didn't spend one dime on the Falcon Heavy rocket.
Elon Musk is doing this on a not-for-profit basis.
Let me finish. He's a capitalist, okay? Let's not be naive about this. He's in it because, A, he has a vision that he got when he was a child to create a multi-planet species. And second of all, he hopes to make a buck on this. Look at Jeff Bezos. He's already talking about an Amazon.com system going from the Earth to the moon, to service the moon with an Amazon-like system. And so, yeah, they see dollar signs. Look at Google. They see asteroids. They see the mining of asteroids. So we can't put our heads in the sand and not say that people aren't dreaming about these things and perhaps making a profit in the meantime, because the government is not going to be financing all these missions. Many of these missions are going to be privately financed. Millions of people tuned in to that launch just 3 weeks ago. Millions of people. Independent of all the concerns we have about global warming and feeding the poor and so on and so forth, because they saw hope. That was a moon rocket that was launched using private funds. And so we have to realize that, well, we can't pit one thing against the other. It's not as if we have a one-track mind that we have to end world hunger tomorrow and 100% of our energy has to go to end world hunger. We have to put things into perspective.
I wonder how you suss out for yourself as a futurist which ideas seem the most plausible. Everybody's got a moonshot idea, literally and metaphorically. What do you think are the common bonds of the ideas that seem the most viable, the most potentially impactful?
Well, NASA has already laid out a timetable, a very solid timetable. Next year, not 20 years from now, next year, the first moon rocket in 50 years will be launched from Cape Canaveral. It'll be a unmanned mission that orbits the moon, powered by the SLS booster rocket. That's already in place. It's already funded. Next will be humans going back to the moon in 2023. And in 2026, we're talking about a lunar orbiter. These are things that are in the NASA budget now. And the president has already said that, A, we want to go to the moon, B, Mars, and C, beyond. And beyond means perhaps in the 2030s, when we may have the capability of shooting rockets safely with passengers all the way to the moon. So this is not simply pie in the sky anymore. Money has been allocated. We have not one, but two moon rockets. The Falcon Heavy and the SLS booster rocket are both capable of putting astronauts in a capsule and to go to the moon to lay the basis for a lunar space station and onto Mars. And so, like I said before, we have to take a look at the long haul rather than simply concentrate on what's happening tomorrow.
We're speaking to physics professor Michio Kaku of the City University of New York, the author of the new book, The Future of Humanity. And we'd love to hear from you, too. What questions do you have about the future of humanity and how we get there? Email us 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Elizabethan writes on our website, the1a.org, our biggest challenge as a species will be overcoming human intellectual resistance to change so that we are capable of managing technological changes proactively. We have allocated our collective responsibility to manage the advancement of the species through technological innovation to exclusively profiteering systems and mechanisms. This is the height of knee-capping stupidity. If we don't start to look at futurism from a holistic perspective, we will continue to build conflicts of interest and short-sightedness into tech innovation. Also, a number of fans of yours, Professor, are listening. Wayne wrote on our Facebook page, I really enjoy listening to Kaku speak because he can take a very complex subject and distill it down to the base idea that makes it easier for people such as myself to understand. And I really appreciate that. It is a very rare gift for someone that is able to do that. One of the ideas that you distill in the book is this idea of what being able to reach Mars and be active there might mean for us. Paint me a picture. I think being able to go to Mars would be awesome, and it feels far-fetched at the same time. But if we made it, if I got there, if I was on one of these missions, what would I see? What would I encounter? What might I do?
Well, first of all, a trip to the moon only takes 3 days. You leave on Monday, and you can literally come back over the weekend. A trip to Mars is different. We're talking about a new planet in outer space, potentially a new home, which means that it takes 2 years, 9 months to reach Mars, then a few months to do experiments and things, and 9 months to come back. And once you get there, you have to realize that it's awfully cold on Mars, meaning that you need shelter. And lava tubes already exist on the surface of Mars that are left over from ancient volcanoes that could serve as a Mars base to protect you against cosmic rays. Then mining operations will start, things that cannot be done by robots. Mining ice. Ice contains, first of all, water for drinking purposes. Second, it can be decomposed into oxygen for breathing. And third, hydrogen for fuel. And then third, we have to have energy. We have to have solar cells that are dispersed throughout the environment so that we can have energy. And then agriculture. This means genetically modifying plants to survive in the harsh Martian conditions so that crops can literally flourish. Crops love carbon dioxide. That's what the atmosphere of Mars is all about. And then long term, and this, of course, is now decades and decades into the future, having solar mirrors in space, which beam solar power to the ice caps, melting the ice cap so that liquid water flows on the surface of Mars once again. Mars once had a great ocean, the size of the United States of America. It had rivers. It had seas. It was a tropical environment. And so we can recreate that by beginning the process of melting the polar ice caps. Now, that, of course, is a long-term prospect. But in the next few decades, people have seriously looked at the cost, the mechanics, and what would it take to create the first settlements on Mars.
There are also a number of programs other than some of the efforts that we've heard about in the headlines. There's one program called Mars One that's gotten some attention. Here's a clip of a news report from Al Jazeera about Mars One.
Jamie Del Rosario is a 27-year-old entrepreneur. She is one of 100 candidates that has been selected by Mars One, a private company that wants to colonize the red planet. The catch? There's no return flight home.
An Al Jazeera report about Mars One. I don't know, Professor, I'm not really excited about going to Mars if it means I will never be able to come home and share my pictures at the family barbecue. That just sounds like a dead issue for me. But what do you think of some of these space ventures, especially for people who say, hey, I'm willing to be the pioneer. If I knew it was a one-way trip, I'd take it.
Well, let's be blunt about this. There are lunatics out there who will make all sorts of crazy, bizarre, unpractical statements about Mars. But that doesn't disguise the fact that honest people are willing to volunteer for a mission to Mars. So no one is talking about going to Mars and dying on Mars. No, we're talking about a round-trip mission. We're talking about the basics of what it would really take with dollars and cents, with money on the table, to go to Mars and to come back. Mars One was a fiction And how do you pay for everything? By selling TV rights. No, come on, give me a break. We're not talking about a science project. We're talking about a publicity stunt called Mars One. Now we're talking about the real thing. NASA has stated that, yes, according to the president's presidential directive, the moon, Mars, and beyond. That is the new mantra within NASA.
Although it's interesting, I'm sorry, Professor, it's interesting that you mention the U.S. government and paying for it. I'm reminded of the last time that we talked about how much a mission to Mars would cost. You mentioned it in your book. It was upwards of $400 billion, and then people were like, then maybe we don't want to. And it went away very quickly once the price tag hit.
Yes, but you realize that prices have dropped like a rock. You know that the movie The Martian with Matt Damon, that cost over $100 million. That's more than the cost of an actual space probe launched by the Indians that reached Mars in 2014. So you realize that Hollywood movies now cost more than an actual flight to Mars. Mm-hmm. Prices have dropped. So the $400 billion figure, that was done in the first era of space exploration when things were really expensive. But now people like Elon Musk want to drop the cost of space travel by a factor of 10 by having reusable rockets. In the same way that the used car industry revolutionized and dropped the prices of new cars, used rockets are going to be the main bulwark of the space program of the future. Prices have dropped, and that's the key. We can't think of what the way it was back in the 1960s when we had the Cold War and anything to thumb our nose at the Russians. Those days are gone. Now we're talking about people who are looking at the dollars and cents, realizing that we can drop the cost of space travel by a factor of 10. And that's what's driving all this enthusiasm, this partnership between NASA and Silicon Valley billionaires.
We have to pause in just a moment. I want to squeeze in one quick comment before we go. Don't Fear the Repair tweeted, Mars is such a red herring. If we're serious about getting our butts into space, a permanent moon base is the most logical step we have. Virgin ground, just a mere 100,000 kilometers away. Before we pause, you talk in the book also about a moon base as kind of a step towards Mars, maybe a necessary step for supply chain reasons.
Yes. And as I mentioned, the richest man in the world, Jeff Bezos, has spent his own money. He's opened his own checkbook to create a rocket base in Texas. Forget Cape Canaveral. He has his own rocket base in Texas, and he wants to create an Amazon delivery system to the moon. His goal is to create the Earth as a park. The Earth becomes a garden. Heavy industry goes into outer space and pollutes outer space. The Earth becomes a garden.
We do have a number of comments about some of the wealthy billionaires who are thinking about making Earth a new kind of Eden. We'll get to some of those as we continue our conversation with Professor Michio Kaku of the City University of New York. His new book is called The Future of Humanity. We'd like to talk about some of your other predictions for the future, Professor. We've gotten some questions about artificial intelligence, what that might mean for us, and about whether or not we actually want to inflict humanity on another planet besides the Earth. Stay close. A quick word about how you can help us with tomorrow's program, where we'll focus on the landmark play Angels in America. It's back on Broadway, 25 years after it premiered there. Angels in America changed how this nation talks about AIDS and about being gay through a dramatic, sometimes fantastical depiction of people dealing with the disease and with American culture. If you've seen Angels in America, how did that play affect you? Maybe you saw a version of it on TV. Maybe you found out about the play at school or college. Maybe you saw it back in the 90s when it debuted. How do you reflect on it, considering how much has changed, and maybe not changed, since then? Leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A. What things have remained the same since the play came out, and how does that affect you, personally? Tell us your story, 855-236-1A1A. That's 855-236-1212, and we will share some of your stories tomorrow on 1A. Back now to our conversation with theoretical physicist and futurist Michio Kaku about his new book, The Future of Humanity. John tweeted, though Elon Musk is undeniably a capitalist, post PayPal, his companies have already and hopefully will expand impact on issues like climate change. His house battery spinoff from Tesla is one example. I share your concern that humanity needs to focus on cleaning our nest, though. Professor Kaku, that is a big theme that has come up in a lot of the comments that we've gotten about humans going to another planet. Jenny wrote on our Facebook page, oh, please, let's not infect another planet with humanity. Linda writes, another planet to exploit and trash? Humanity needs to end here on the perfectly balanced, beautiful planet they ruined. And Doug tweeted, what steps do you think we'll take to make sure that if we do go to other planets, we'll have a low environmental impact on that planet? I know that right now we're just concentrating on getting there, but will we have negative impacts there like we're facing here on Earth? Professor?
Well, first of all, I agree with the comments there that we have to make sure that we preserve the Earth, because the Earth is our home. The Earth is a spaceship. And therefore, if we ruin the Earth, then where are we going to go? I do not believe that we should create settlements on Mars to escape the greenhouse effect, to escape all the mess that we've created on the planet Earth. There are some people who say that. I'm not one of them. I don't think we should go to Mars just because we've messed up the Earth and we have another planet to mess up. I think we should get our act together. All I'm saying is that we shouldn't pit the two against each other. Now, for example, you mentioned Elon Musk. He's a capitalist. He's out there to make a buck. He has a vision, a multi-planet species, but he is, at the bottom line, a capitalist. But what is he investing in? Electric power. You realize that the reason why we don't have a solar age is because of the battery, the storage. We forget that. We constantly forget that the reason why we don't have wind farms and solar farms everywhere is because what do you do when the sun doesn't shine and the winds don't blow? We need super batteries. And that's what Tesla Motors is all about. Tesla is promoting the super battery because prices are dropping 7% per year to create batteries that can store sunlight when the sun doesn't shine and when the winds don't blow. So here we have a capitalist who's on the front edge, the leading edge of an environmental revolution, the electric revolution. So my point again is don't pit these two against each other, because it's like shooting yourself in the foot, okay? And that's why I'm saying that, yes, we should not mess up the Earth. We should make sure that we clean up our act, but there's no reason why we shouldn't have an insurance policy.
There's also the human aspect of being a two-planet species. Brian emailed, the problem with a two-planet species is that the new planet will be for the wealthy only. So what sounds like a great plan really amounts to a two-class planet system.
Well, I don't see that, because I think, first of all, most rich people are probably not going to want to go to Mars. The first people that will go to Mars that are consumers will probably be tourists. There are a lot of tourist sites on Mars that would be spectacular if they were on the Earth. The largest volcano in the solar system, a Grand Canyon network the size of the United States of America, picturesque polar ice caps. So I think the first people to go to Mars are not going to be wealthy people. They may not want to endure the hardship of a two-year journey to the red planet. I think for the most part, they're going to be hardy people who want to create a new life, and tourists, as I mentioned, and scientists who want to explore this entirely new world. So I think rich people, for the most part, will stay home.
I'm not sure I buy that at all. If I was going to take this trip, I need to make sure that I am economically able to take the trip. I can't take 2 years off from work if I'm living paycheck to paycheck. I'd rather just go to Disney World and do my vacation there than go to another planet. I mean, how would someone even be able to contemplate leaving the Earth, let alone the educational gap that comes into having an awareness of interstellar travel? You talk about how there's a certain degree, or envision that there's a certain degree of training that would have to go into this. You might have to kind of go for a few days and prepare yourself for going into space. If I'm living paycheck to paycheck, ain't nobody got time for that. How is that not just going to be a vacation spot for the rich?
Well, when new technology comes online, let's face it, the rich people are going to be first in line, okay? And eventually, prices drop. Now, does that mean we stop research? Does that mean we close down our medical laboratories? Does that mean we go back to the Middle Ages just because wealthy people would get the advantage of biotechnology and modern medicine first? No, that's shooting yourself in the foot. I mean, that's crazy talk. So what I'm saying is, yes, initially, people who can afford it will go into outer space and to Mars. For example, if you want to go up into outer space with Richard Branson and Air Force Two, it costs about $200,000. That's right, $200,000 to go straight up 70 miles into outer space on a rocket ship for tourists. Well, Jeff Bezos wants to bring down the cost a bit more, but the point here is that as time goes by, as technology becomes mass-produced, as it becomes more commonplace, prices drop. But does that mean that we abandon all these technologies just because it's for the rich? No, that's shooting yourself in the foot.
We also got some questions about what being able to go to Mars would do to us as living human beings. Dan is listening in Silver Spring, Maryland, not far from here, and he asked, if a lunar or Martian colony fails, would the inhabitants conceived outside of Earth's atmosphere and gravity be able to migrate to Earth? Would their immune systems and skeletons ever be able to adapt to thrive on Earth independent of advanced medical technology? And Benjamin tweeted, can you speak about the long-term effects of less than glamorous gravity on the human body? Our entire biology evolved around Earth gravity. Some of what you do write about is the difference between being able to act in the environment of our 1G Earth and the, I guess it would be 0.6G environment of Mars. Even some astronauts who spend long periods of time on the space station come home to Earth so weak they can barely walk out of the capsule.
That's right. The weightlessness is a problem. That means we're going to have constant exercises on this 2-year journey to Mars. Once you get to Mars, the gravitational pull there is about a third that of the planet Earth. And it does mean now in the long term, this is once we have permanent settlements, not just people going there for a few years and coming back to Earth, but people are going to have to adjust to different kinds of conditions. Now, science fiction writers have had a field day about this because they foresee a time, maybe thousands of years in the future, when we become a multi-planet species, that we may have to genetically modify ourselves. That's something that we have to think about. Now, the point I'm raising is, do we have a choice in the matter? We forget that Mother Earth has destroyed 99.9% of all living forms. They've gone extinct. Extinction is the norm. We think Mother Nature is benevolent and kind and loves human beings. Well, to a degree. But 99.9% of all life forms on the Earth have disappeared, gone extinct, kaput. They're gone. They're not here to argue the question anymore. Now, do we want to go the same way? I don't think so. That's why I'm saying we need an insurance policy. And yeah, we have to pay the premiums. One of the premiums would be that perhaps as we go to other star systems, we may have to genetically modify ourselves to adjust or die.
I think as soon as you went into genetic modification, I can hear some people going, I don't know, this is starting to sound tougher and tougher, which kind of brings up the question of how much change human beings will tolerate. I mean, there's a clip from the BBC of you out on the streets of New York asking people, for example, if they would like to be immortal. And here are some of the responses you got.
I think life would become mundane. I think that human emotions would suffer profoundly.
Sure, absolutely. I like life, and I'd be quite happy to live an awful lot more of it.
Too sad when all my loved ones pass. Too sad when my world disappears. Already I'm sick of everything.
It would be so boring to live forever. It would just be awful, I think.
That's a clip from a series of interviews you did that was heard on the BBC. It sounds like some people are resistant to dramatically changing what it means to be human, even if it might mean a more prosperous, healthier, longer future. You connect this to something you call the caveman principle. What is the caveman principle?
Well, we are genetically identical in terms of our personality with our ancestors 100,000 years ago when we first emerged from Africa. And what do we want? After shelter and mates and food, we want to look good. We want to have prestige. We want to earn the respect of people of the opposite sex. So that means that there's going to be a limit to how much we modify ourselves. In science fiction, we have stories of a brain encased in a vat of liquid that is simply pure thought, or electrodes dangling from your head. But no, I don't see that's the future, because that violates the caveman and cavewoman principle that we want to look good to our peers. We don't want to look like a freak. We don't want to look like somebody who's an outcast. So even as we begin the process of changing ourselves, our basic structure is going to look pretty much the same. So I think science fiction novels sometimes get it wrong. They have humans looking like gigantic people with big heads and small bodies and hairless bodies that can survive in the reaches of outer space. I don't think that's the way we're going to evolve. I think we're going to be pretty much the same as we were in the past. Now, also in the BBC special, I also went to an old age home, a nursing home, and I asked the same question. Would you want to live forever? These people were dying. They were in constant pain. They were constantly reminded of the fact that all their loved ones had died already, and their turn was coming very soon. And what did they say? Sure. They will gobble down the fountain of youth. So I think it's easy when you're a young person to say, I don't need the fountain of youth. Ask that same person when they're on their deathbed.
Lots of questions we'd love to get to, but I did want to get to one that I think is on a lot of people's minds as it relates to the future. Paul in Missouri emailed, it seems that the future hinges on AI, artificial intelligence. I want my AI to be ugly. Not cute and fuzzy. I want to know it as artificial. I want my AI to help me with my deficits, not control me via the illusion of convenience. I don't want my AI to spy on me or mine my content. I don't want my AI to just pile on more desire and anxiety. I want my AI to enhance my experience of reality, not replace it. I don't want to be a slave to something that I don't really need but am compelled to live with.
Well, the media talked about a battle of billionaires between Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook and Elon Musk of SpaceX, where Zuckerberg said that AI is going to create jobs, new industries, prosperity. It's going to reinvigorate the economy. While Elon Musk said, let's not be naive. One day they're going to take over, they're going to put us in zoos, throw peanuts at us, and make us dance behind bars. Well, I told CNN when they interviewed me about this that, well, both of them have a point. In the short term, I think Zuckerberg is right. I think that we are going to have new jobs, new industries, tremendous economic productivity coming from artificial intelligence in the short term, that is, over the next many decades. But long term, by the end of this century, we have to watch out. So what is the tipping point? The tipping point is when robots become self-aware. Robots do not know they are robots. You cannot go to a robot and joke with it and talk about humans and robots and whether they're going to take over. Robots are adding machines. We forget that. They don't think the way we think. But it's only a matter of time before they will have that ability to be self-aware. At that point, we should put a chip in their brain to shut them off if they have murderous thoughts.
Ben Moe in Manchester, New Hampshire writes, it's unfortunate people think concerning ourselves with space is a waste of time and resources, yet they are using a cell phone, which is an unintended benefit of the space wars of the Cold War era. So is Uber, satellite technology used for agriculture, drones, etc. It's naive to be always backward-looking. I was a high school senior when the Challenger exploded, more than 30 years ago. Unlike students in America, I was watching it in Kenya. In East Africa. Dr. Kaku is the son of Carl Sagan and grandson of Einstein, as far as I am concerned. I know our time is short, but I wonder with regards to these benefits. And Ben Moe is absolutely right. We can't ignore the fact that our willingness to dream way beyond commercial utility of science is what's allowed a lot of commercial utilities to come about. There's no denying that. Can you give me an example of where someone who might be skeptical or cynical might begin to see some of these futuristic benefits? Where might it first show up in my life, based on your predictions?
Well, first of all, this conversation is given to you, compliments of the space program. The space program forced industry to miniaturize transistors and to put them into outer space. That gave rise to the internet and cell phones. So the goodies that you see in your living room that makes life so convenient, that allows us to instantaneously communicate with other people around the world, are byproducts of the space program, which forced the miniaturization of transistors. Now people are saying that the second golden age that we're now entering will force the development of quantum computers, force the development of molecular transistors, force industry to create the next generation of consumer goods, which are going to reinvigorate the economy and create more prosperity. So let's not forget that the prosperity that we enjoy today is not by accident. It didn't come from outer space. It didn't come from aliens like some people think.
Right.
No, a lot of it came from the space program.
Would you go to Mars?
Personally, no. Mainly because, of course, you got to be an astronaut. You got to be like an Air Force pilot. You got to believe that, yes, there are dangers involved, but you want the glory and you're courageous enough to do it. I'm not courageous enough.
Well, I mean, like, if we could just, you know, send you there, would you go?
Well, if I could be teleported to Mars, sure. I mean, why not? It's a whole nother world. And they're, like I mentioned, tourist attractions that are spectacular compared to the attractions that we see on the planet Earth. Mountains bigger than Mount Everest are commonplace on Mars. Volcanoes, Grand Canyons, tremendous features on Mars that would be tremendous tourist attractions on the Earth.
Michio Kaku, futurist and professor of physics at the City University of New York. His new book is called The Future of Humanity, Terraforming Mars, Interstellar Travel, Immortality, and Our Destiny Beyond Earth. Professor Kaku, we appreciate your time. Thanks for talking to us.
Glad to be on.
This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.